We're about to meet Harvey, Svi, and Rima, as well as the voice of a narrator who is exploring the complex emotional terrain of these characters in Atmospheric Disturbances, a novel by Rivka Galshin. You think of me as useless, Dr. Leo. I can see that. That's okay. But Dr. Galshin doesn't think like you. Soon enough, you'll understand the essential niche I fulfill. Until then, I can weather the indignity of your indifference. As Harvey rambled on, it became vivid to me that Harvey deployed Svi as a kind of psychotic patch, a mending of the rent caused in his universe by the unflagging perception of his own insignificance. Seeing Harvey so unable to understand Svi as a real person, seeing him misunderstand Svi as whatever Harvey most needed him to be, a new kind of sadness blossomed in me. The narrator goes on to describe Rima's indifference, too. Rima, who would just sit in front of the TV alone at night, spooning from a bowl of cereal, and at the same time telling me she wasn't hungry for dinner, thus leaving me to eat takeout alone, while I had recently taken to staying late at the hospital. Words from Atmospheric Disturbances, a novel by Rivka Galshin, a critically acclaimed writer who will read from her recent nonfiction book Little Labors tomorrow evening at Wilkes University. Perhaps it's not fair, but in getting to know something of Rivka Galshin's background, we can point to a number of details in what we've just heard from Atmospheric Disturbances. You may have noticed that she refers to a character named Dr. Galshin. She uses her own father's name for this character, her father who was a meteorologist in their household in Oklahoma, a household rooted in the worlds of science and technology. In fact, Rivka would eventually go on to receive a medical degree with a focus in psychiatry from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And so there are interesting reverberations when she describes Harvey as he uses Svi as a kind of psychotic patch, and yet she also uses the phrase, the rent caused in his universe by the unflagging perception of his own insignificance. Rivka Galshin has also written about quantum physics and post-Newtonian understandings of the universe in journals like Scientific American, so she can explore both inner and outer universes in a remarkable way. In a selection we've just shared, she even mentions cereal. And growing up in her home, she tells us there were not many books, so she read whatever was available, over and over, and that included all the power-packed words on the cereal boxes at the breakfast table. As we suggested, this citing of details may not be fair, because it might give the impression that Rivka Galshin just writes about what she knows. On the contrary, what she knows is just a kind of launching pad for her explorations, and she uses the image of a sea voyage in an interview about her recent nonfiction book, Little Labors. I'm told that people who work seriously with puppets don't like the term puppeteer, or the idea that the puppeteer is determining what the puppet does. The puppet has a natural destiny, has its own things to express, and the puppeteer's job is just to help the puppet be what it's meant to be. Writing this book was an unfamiliar experience in the sense that I usually find that it requires a real effort for me to turn off my drive to captain everything. Here I didn't have that problem. Instead, I had to beg the captain to come intervene. My frontal cortex was so dimmed out by fatigue and love of my baby that the ship was just a floating party going nowhere. It was like there was just a lump of felt, no puppet constraint. I don't know why I feel moved to go by land and by sea, both in these mixed metaphors, but I'm trying to say that usually when I write, I'm trying to dismiss the captain. And in this book, it was more like I kept sending out messages in a bottle, hoping the captain would return, if only for just long enough to teach me how to use the sextant. Words of writer Rivka Galshin from an interview with Vincent Scarpa in Tin House about her book, Little Labors, from which she'll read tomorrow evening at Wilkes University. Rivka Galshin completed her Master of Fine Arts degree at Columbia University, where she was a Robert Bingham Fellow. In 2006, she published her first collection of short stories titled American Innovations. Her first novel, Atmospheric Disturbances, became a finalist for the Mercantile Library's John Sargent Senior First Novel Prize and Canada's Governor General's Literary Award. She is the recipient of a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and is a 2015 Guggenheim Fellow. The Wilkes University English Department will host the Alan Hamilton Dixon Fund Spring Writers Series featuring Rivka Galshin. The series will open tomorrow at the Kirby Hall on South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The event is free and open to the public. We had a chance to speak by phone with Rivka Galshin before her visit to northeastern Pennsylvania, and we began with those early days.
In some ways, I think it was a kind of connection to literature, just having, in a sense, almost nothing to read but a hunger for reading, so that, you know, the sight of the cereal box did feel magical and those words did feel magical. But I was really lucky, and in high school I had an incredible English teacher for 2 years, Dr. Ballard. And she did that thing where she had us try and learn how to pronounce Middle English, and we studied the Canterbury Tales and would make us read it out loud and would sort of draw our attention to all the details, like the wife of Bath wearing red tights, and just revealed that it was funny, that it was playful, that it was wild, even as it seemed old and eternal, that it was both of those things. I mean, I had the good fortune of an amazing, wonderful English teacher, and I think that was crucial for me, even though I also think, in a funny way, being starved for things to read, although I wouldn't suggest it as a parenting strategy, can make it so powerful when you do become a reader.
Well, that's a beautiful tribute to a teacher, to somebody who really did open a world in that way. And you do have a sense in your writing of the power of the word and words and that wildness and the musicality of language. And that was already there, yes. For you, you think it's innate, that ear?
I think that's a thing where people do open it up for you. And, you know, it's funny because teachers are, I saw my high school English teacher not that long ago, and she very recently retired, and she can't even go out without someone wanting to pay for her meal. Because, you know, she's sort of famous in town because she's so meaningful to so many people. But for me, I think it is that mixture of just finding the person who's going to unlock something that's waiting in you. And, you know, my mother doesn't like to read, but her emails always have such wild word choices that I love. And my father also had, like, very unusual word choices. Like, his answering machine would say, would return your call as soon as feasible. I always loved that. It was so precise. So I think it's a mixture of family and someone unlocking it.
You just mentioned your parents, and our listeners might not know that you grew up in a household that was more scientifically oriented than literary in that way. Dad and Mom both had scientific or technical expertise.
Yeah, I thought that was a beautiful way into language. My mother did computer programming, and she came into computer programming because English was her second language, so it was daunting for her to work as a teacher in a second language, but computers were a language, so there was that aspect of sort of already seeing that scientific vocabulary as a way to communicate. And then my father was a meteorologist, and, you know, there's so many beautiful words in the weather. Like, I always loved the word nowcasting, that you don't just forecast, but you have to nowcast, which is equally difficult to be able to describe what's going on right now. And I always thought, oh, that's beautiful beyond science. That somehow captures something I hadn't felt there was a word for, but that we're all experiencing.
You have been able to understand the world and help us understand the world by being able to be precise but also fresh in your use of language and your descriptions.
I felt so fortunate to have a sort of upbringing in milieu, which I really owe mostly to teachers, so a series of teachers, such that scientific thinking and language seems to me as creative, if sometimes maybe a little bit harder to access in it just being in a foreign language, as poetry or as literature. And I'm especially drawn to people where it seems you have just an openness to whatever the material is, whether it's someone writing a memoir or writing about an airplane being built or writing about sort of feelings within a family, that those things are all, they're all kind of equal on a plane of being worth inspecting creatively.
And isn't it exciting how artists and creative people often anticipate or reflect the worldview of the time in which they live and write and create? There's a certain perception of the world or a worldview that comes across naturally in the way the language is used and the forms that are chosen and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. That's such a beautiful way to put it. I even think it's almost sort of when we read something old, we get to, you know, for lack of a better analogy, we get to see the light of a candle as opposed to the light of a light bulb. Like, we're so used to the light of a light bulb, and then you think, oh, there's completely different material also generating light, which is this thing we're very familiar with. And so you learn not just about what the topic is, but what the source of illumination is.
There's a different understanding that we're coming to have to absorb about the way the world is now as interpreted through scientific understanding. And as we've said, sometimes it's the creative artists who help us begin to embrace those changes.
Absolutely. And the way that that has an emotional repercussion, you know, that it's sort of a... that it changes the way we feel when we wake up in the morning to know that we're sort of one planet around one star in one galaxy. Even just that sort of information, we forget how new it is and how we've internalized it and how it changes just the way we feel about moving through space. And I don't know, I think it's sometimes processed as threatening when really I sort of feel like it sort of opens up even the most ordinary experiences, start to feel that they're carrying all of this context and all of these sort of beautiful secrets that are becoming visible.
And I read that you said you see yourself as risk averse, but it seems to me that in your writing, you certainly take all kinds of risks and help us to go with you to those places that are open. You're willing to go and explore there without knowing what's going to happen.
That's generous. And it's true, I feel like I'm very risk averse in terms of myself and my body and space, but I really love being an amateur, being the person who doesn't know. I'm not embarrassed by that. And I do think that can be such a useful quality for a writer, whether in journalism or in fiction, to be really, really comfortable failing or being ignorant and just and having that be revealed as you're trying to work. Like I once someone did a beautiful reading of the Keats poem upon first looking into Chapman's Homer, and they drew attention to the point that, you know, Keats was revealing that he had to read Homer in translation, and he makes errors about other historical figures in the poem, but it ends up just being part of what's moving about the poem is that he reveals so much that he doesn't know, and so in a sense, you get the picture of someone who's so hungry to know and not afraid to show that they're not already there. So it seems natural to me to sort of embrace being an amateur and being okay with making mistakes and not being the one in the know.
Well, that leads us perhaps to the question of so much we want to be in control because we are afraid of not being able to handle what's put before us. I'm talking to you from a public radio and television station, and down the hall is a room-sized mural of all our friends from Sesame Street. Oscar,
aww,
the Count, and Elmo, they're all on the wall. You used the image or the metaphor of puppets and puppetry when you were talking about, as a writer, not wanting to be pulling the strings all the time, that puppets can have a life of their own in a certain sense.
One of the things, for example, about even the Muppets that's so beautiful is the puppeteer has a lot of control, but there's something very material about a puppet. There are limits to what you can do for it, to it. There's sort of natural expressions it leans to. It. There is a kind of give and take between the puppet and the puppeteer, and I think that's, you know, apt for whatever someone is making. Even when you're outside of the arts, even if you're raising a child or running a business, the fact that you don't have complete control, that the material feeds back at you, whether it's a person or a group or a clay or a puppet, seems to me like a positive thing, because then you're not making it alone. You're making something bigger than you and better than you. because there's something else feeding in.
What was wonderful also in the description, you were referring to the Bunraku tradition in Japan, and I was curious because Little Labors, your book, has a Japanese model. Is Japan and the culture of Japan something of particular interest to you, or was this just one of the lovely things that you've encountered in your life and you were responding to the ancient collection?
It is sort of an accidental, constant interest. Sometimes I think it's as simple as when I was a child, I think my father received a lot of mail from Japan, and the stamps were so beautiful to me. And there was a time when there was going to be a Subaru factory was going to come move to our town of Norman, Oklahoma. And so the schools did a lot of cultural training to teach us about Japanese culture in order to better receive what we had hoped was going to be a lot of Japanese children to the town. But of course, the Subaru executives came and they didn't bring their children. So we had done all this preparation to receive nobody in particular. But in a sense, that was sort of like a magical. It's funny, the things that you learn about when you're a child last longer than the things you learn about as an adult or have a different kind of imprint. So for some reason, I have spent my whole life again and again finding myself turning with interest to Japanese literature and Japanese culture and Japanese history, Japanese movies. I don't know why.
And you'll be reading from Little Labors for us when you come?
Yes.
Can you describe for our listeners the connection with the Japanese text that you were maybe having a conversation with?
Yeah, well, Little Labors is a book that I ended up putting together. A lot of it just the small little notes and thoughts that came to me while I was with my daughter in the first year of her life. And not all of the thoughts are necessarily about a baby, but they all sort of have a certain something about them that in one way or another comes from being near a baby, not having a lot of sleep, that very special space you're in, the space where you're very in love and you're very tired and you're just in another place. And so those notes all come from that time period. And they came together as a miscellany. And I had in mind, before I had my baby, I wanted to write a piece about two female Japanese writers from about 1,000 years ago, Kei Shonagin and Murasaki Tsukibu. And Kei Shonagin's book, it's called The Pillow Book, which makes it sound much racier than it is. But it's a collection of miscellany, but part of why it's so enchanting and still around 1,000 years later is that something about the jottings and the insights still feels so modern. There's not a huge barrier. Her inner life doesn't seem so alien to us in certain ways. And so it's always been a kind of powerful book to me and also of interest to me that 1,000 years ago, the two most enduring writers from Japan 1,000 years ago were both women. And I wanted to write an essay about that, and I couldn't quite do it because I was so in love and with my baby all the time. So this book came from not writing that essay, but ended up still being influenced by those texts I wanted to write about.
Again, that's that wonderful ability to have literature be alive 1,000 years after it was created, and your interaction as a young person with Chaucer and the impact that that could have. We were talking about your dear little one, and I think it was just an enchanting essay about lullabies and fascinating the way you enter into what a lullaby might be through the Hitchcock film, The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah, absolutely. That came out of, I had the opportunity to write about this beautiful project, the Lullaby Project, where a team of musicians, most of them from Carnegie Hall, go into the community and work with young mothers and help the young mothers write a song for their newborn baby, and partially to express the feelings that they have, because being a mother, of course, can sometimes be quite isolating, and it's hard to have a chance to share your feelings with another adult, and also as a way to form a connection with this baby, think about the baby out loud in song form, which is so emotive. So it was just very moving to report on the piece. And as with anything, when you sort of have your head really in another space, the whole world starts to look different. So the Hitchcock film, The Man Who Knew Too Much, which many, many people have seen, and of course, whatever stage in your life you're in, you notice different parts about the movie. Because I was so in this world of the connection between a parent and a child through song, suddenly it seems so much more powerful. The plot hinges on the mother who has retired from singing in order to be a mother, really. The plot hinges on them finding their kidnapped child again by singing the song that the child would sing with his mother. And that seemed always just like kind of a machinery in the movie before, like just, you know, a clever trick to hold the movie together and to make the reunion occur. But suddenly it seemed actually much more deep and powerful than it had seemed to me when I was watching the movie with my head in a different place.
Writing, literature, the arts, what role do you see them playing in our lives at this time in the 21st century?
Yeah, I mean, there's something right now about this moment where I think a lot of people, myself included, feel quite flattened. It seems sort of like there's sort of, sometimes it feels like there's only two inner lives available and everyone's having the same inner life, whether from one side of the political spectrum or the other. That's not actually true, but it does feel that way, which is a terrible feeling. And what I feel optimistic and hopeful about is that I feel that any form of sustained thinking and sustained work, which isn't 140 characters, which isn't a sort of alarming, adrenaline-inducing headline, which isn't clickbait, which is just so valuable. And I think there's so many forms that work can take. It can take the form of a story or a song, because those involve sort of sustained thinking and sustained work. And it can take the form of a friendship, or can take the form of I feel much more invested in teaching and being a student than I ever have before. So I think what's beautiful about any form of work, whether it's work in the arts, which is sustained work and sustained thinking, which isn't simple, which isn't highly reactive, which isn't in the moment, it's not 10 seconds ago, it's sort of longer and more thoughtful, feels more important to me than ever before. So for me, that's my connection to the arts still seeming important, even though I feel like many people sort of flattened by headlines several times a day.
Award-winning writer Rivka Galshin speaking with us about her life and work before her reading tomorrow evening at Wilkes University, opening the Allen Hamilton Dixon Spring Writers Series. That's Tuesday, February 28th at 7 in the Salon of Kirby Hall, 202 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The reading is free and open to the public. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu. Rivka Galshin speaking at Wilkes University tomorrow evening at 7 in the Salon of Kirby Hall, 202 South River Street in Wilkes-Barre. The reading is free, and for more information on the web, wilkes.edu, wilkes.edu.